This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Ever since the pocket protector was invented, and probably long before then, people interested in science have been considered nerds, dweebs, outcasts, geeks, losers. Now it's one man's quest to change all that.
Bill Nye the Science Guy.
Bill Nye the Science Guy.
Bill.
Bill Nye the Science Guy.
Science rules. Inertia is a property of matter.
Bill Nye the Science Guy.
Brought to you by Chock Full of Lead Coffee, bursting with heavy metal flavor.
Bill Nye is the creator, host, and head writer of the TV show Bill Nye the Science Guy, which airs weekdays on public television and weekends on commercial stations around the country. Through a frenetic mix of video clips, scientific explanations, song and movie parodies, cheap sound effects, bad puns, and do-it-yourself experiments, Bill Nye the Science Guy proves beyond a doubt that science is cool. With lab coat and bow tie intact, he jumps out of airplanes to demonstrate gravity, or scuba dives to get a first-hand look at undersea invertebrates. Although the show is aimed at 9 to 11-year-olds, over half its viewers now, in its fifth year in syndication, are adults, people like me, and possibly you, who have only the shakiest grounding in basic science. Each show is designed to teach the audience two concepts about the show's theme. I asked Bill Nye what the learning objectives were for the show on smell.
Animal sense of smell is a process that detects molecules in the air or water. And then human smell is very, very sensitive, or your senses of smell are very, very sensitive. And the most astonishing example of this are salmon, which apparently can smell one molecule in 30 quadrillion. Sharks are in the tens of trillions. Humans are one in a million. Some people think one in 10 million. So basically what we did, we had popcorn cooking in a microwave at the center of a basketball court. And then how long would it take you to smell it? Not very long, turns out. And it's just like a milliliter of popcorn molecules in the air is all you need to smell it. A shark then could detect the very tippy tip of a fine, fine artist's paintbrush full of blood in an Olympic-sized pool. And then a salmon could detect that blood in, I'd say, 100 Olympic-sized pools. It's quite remarkable. Salmon thing is pretty jaw-dropping. They're really cranked up. So you rely on your sense of smell way more than you realize.
Now, are there subjects you've considered too controversial for the program?
Well,
I'm thinking of, say, I don't know, cancer or evolution. Or you might have done a show on evolution.
We did do a show on evolution. And I got to tell you, it is generally regarded that we pulled a punch on evolution. So for you fans out there, coming up this season will be the Patterns show. And patterns are a topic that people are really excited about in science education these days. Because that's apparently related to how human brains process information. In the Pattern show, we're going to have a bit about evolution. See, it's just ironic that we have this society here. Everybody that's listening to the show right now is listening on the radio, which is a result of humans' understanding of electromagnetic radiation, which is what the sun gives off, and Jupiter, and places like that. And it's this intimate understanding of science, and yet we have this weird sort of segment of our population in the United States that for some reason doesn't fully embrace evolution, doesn't fully accept it. Yet they're more than happy to use their blenders and drive their cars and everything else that the same process of understanding the world has brought us, or the cash machine. Because the evidence, I mean, evolution isn't a theory. I mean, I guess it was a century ago or something. I mean, evolution is a fact. I mean, it's just, that's how it is. And the other topic that we've talked about doing that we never really addressed directly was sex. Sex, sex, sex! But if you've ever seen the show on flowers, that's a lot of the flower show is about sex. Because the reason flowers are so successful is their the way they mix their genes, which is sex.
And why haven't you done a show on sex?
Well, it's generally agreed, and I'm right there, that it's too personal a thing, that parents want to control that. They don't want this kooky guy jumping in their living room and telling their kids about sex. They want to, it's a personal thing. They want to impart that knowledge themselves, and I think that might even be genetic. That might even be deep in our genes that need to control that part of your child. You know, if you're a mammal, and you are, the big thing that makes mammals different from a lot of other animals is that we need our parents. We need adult, you know, it takes a whole village to raise a child, well, that kind of thing. You need adults around to become a successful adult yourself. Did okay. I go off on a tangent there for
no,
you?
No, I'm happy to have you talk about
but
sex
flowers,
on this show.
Flowers and sex, that's sort of one and the same thing. And humans and sex, we've decided not really to address too much on the show. But
it seems as if there was a kind of science blackout for years on children's television. I'm thinking when I grew up, there wasn't all that much to watch. But now there are lots of TV programs about science. There's the Magic School Bus. There's Newton's Apple, Beekman's World. Of course, Bill Nye, the Science Guy. Is this just a television fad, or do you understand it as science time has come? It's now a hot commodity in popular culture.
Well, both. By that I mean its cycle has come around again, and it is a hot topic right now. And the guy that I had when I was very young, and I was so young that I didn't get most of it, was Mr. Wizard, Don Herbert, who's still around, and he comes to science teacher conventions to reassure you out there. He's 80. He's kind of hard of hearing, but he's a genius. You know what I mean? As I say, he sent this country to the moon. You know, but after he retired, there was a void, and I don't know why that is exactly. And a big problem that's very well documented in studies done in the education community is that people who were raised in this void that you're talking about, in this era, say from the mid-60s, right after the success of the Apollo missions to the early 1990s, you know, period of almost 20 years, people who were raised in that time and became teachers do not have this firm science background that that we would like them to have. And I say we, people in society, would like them to have. You, as a parent, would like them to have. And so there's a lot of evidence to suggest that over half of what you learn about science, what you learn about anything, comes from sources outside of school, what's called technically called informal education. So on my show, we're doing our best to enhance informal education and bring it up to as high a level as we can. And along with that, during when these wacky, nutty kids, what's his name, Bill Clinton, took over, there had been in place for years something called the Children's Television Act. But through processes that I'm not really an expert on at all, but these laws were not enforced. The Children's Television Act was not really enforced because it would have been such a far-reaching thing. Anyway, when a new set of administrators got to Washington in the early 90s, they thought they'd enforce these laws, and they actually threatened to revoke station licenses, television station licenses, if they didn't provide, and the wording has been kicked around a lot, if they didn't provide what they called programming that was primarily educational. So when that happened, there was this big, everybody in, all the producers in the country, or many producers, really tried to hustle to make television educational.
Every show, you feature profiles of scientists. And
what we call the way cool scientists.
The way cool scientists. And I've noticed maybe a disproportionate number of them are women. And traditionally, of course, girls are the ones who fall behind in their interest in science in high school, maybe in middle school. Is this part of a conscious effort on the show to reach out to young girls? Are they still science shy?
Yes, yes, yes. It is absolutely a conscious effort to reach out to young girls and to what nowadays what we're called people of color. The thing is, you have a society where half the workforce is women, let's say, for example. You have to have, in my opinion, you have to have half of the scientists to be women, or you're going to have an unbalanced view of science. You're going to have an unbalanced view of the world. It gets into this deal where science is not the ultimate truth. Science is this process of discovering the world. So you have to have people of color and women in science, or you're going to have, I'm going to argue, inferior science. So yes, it's a conscious effort. But let me say, it's an interesting thing. There aren't more women scientists shown on the show on the Way Cool Scientist segment. I'll bet you, Barbara, it's that you notice them.
Huh.
I'll bet you it's that you go, wow, look at I didn't expect that. But of course, there's a huge number of women doing fantastic science, and we try to feature them on the Way Cool Scientist segment. But the little goal of the show, Barbara, my little goal as host and head writer is to, dare I say it, change the world. That's really what I'm going for. Trying to get women and kids of color, or girls and kids of color, excited about science. So in the future, we will have enough scientists to save the world, or the world for humans.
Bill Nye is my guest. He's the host and the head writer of the nationally syndicated children's science show, Bill Nye, the Science Guy, which airs weekdays on PBS and weekends on commercial stations around the country. We're going to talk some more after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Bill Nye, host and writer of the nationally syndicated science show for kids, Bill Nye, the Science Guy. There's a famous documentary that I'm pretty sure you might have seen. It's a series of interviews with Harvard graduates on graduation day, right? They've got their clapboards on, yeah. Right? They have their diplomas in hand, and they're asked to explain why it's warmer in the summer.
That's right, yeah.
And virtually none of them can do it. It's just amazing. And they come up with the most hilariously, scientifically illiterate answers.
Now, before we go too far, Barbara,
yeah,
can I ask you?
Oh, please.
Why is it warmer in the summer?
Now, I know it's about the axis and the earth is tilted and it
That's it.
Spins.
That's a key word.
Yes, right.
The key word is that the earth is tilted. And so when we did a show on the earth's seasons, we reiterated that often.
Okay. Okay.
The earth
okay.
is tilted.
Why is it that people can leave Harvard not having reached basic competency in science?
I'm not an expert on that, but I'll tell you right now, I think it's really bad. And here's why I think it's bad. We have gotten to this point in the world, human history, or in history of the Earth, where everybody buys a calendar, everybody wears a wristwatch, everybody has a computer that has a clock on it. And the computer runs, by the way, with a clock in its central processing unit. That's what CPU means, for those of you who didn't know. And it uses the clock to access data and to have so-called interrupt-driven programs and so on. And it's humans' understanding of the passage of time that has allowed us to have a society. It's a way, understanding clocks is a way more significant thing than understanding the wheel. There was a time, an era, when people would actually lose count of the number of days of the year, when the Nile was going to flood. And they would not have crops. They would like starve. They would like mess up their agriculture because they didn't have this understanding that we take so for granted. And then to have people graduating from our universities without this fundamental understanding of what makes the earth seasons,
so how,
it's crushing.
So how do you define scientific literacy? What should we all have a handle on to get along in life?
I think everybody has to have a fundamental understanding of the seasons. Everybody has to have a fundamental understanding of where the Earth is in the solar system. For example, do you know what keeps the air on the Earth's surface? It's a really interesting question. It's gravity.
Gravity.
Yeah. It's the same thing that makes the Earth round. The Earth is rounder than the shiniest ball bearing or BB you've ever seen. And that's because of gravity. And yet, interestingly enough, Barbara, no one really knows exactly what causes gravity. I mean, we're very close to understanding, but we don't really actually know that. Anyway, so that would be very important, I think, to know what holds the air and ocean on the Earth. There's a lot of things, Barbara, I'm sorry. There's a lot of things everybody should know about science, and I'm sure there are many things that I should know that I don't know. But that's the charm of science, is that it's a process. You always learn, constantly picking up new stuff.
Before you were the science guy, were you the science nerd?
Yes, I was the science nerd. I was in high school as a proud member of the Mad Scientist Club. There were four or five of us, depending on the count. We actually... We wore ties to school. We were so backward. We actually wore ties to school. as sort of a, you know, to show respect for our teachers. That was how nutty it was.
Do you remember the first time you were in a school science class and you thought, wow, this is really cool. This is what I want to do with my life.
Yeah, I think so. Well, I remember a couple times, but I remember it's in second grade, and we had made barometers out of bottles with eyedroppers in them, because the eyedropper provides a tube from a liquid up to the up above the surface of the bottle. Do you know what I mean? Anyway, and they overflowed when a thunderstorm came. The atmospheric pressure got so low that the barometers were, in a sense, exploding all over the classroom, you know, food coloring running all over the floor.
Now that
and
is
Mrs.
cool.
Mrs. McGonagall. Yeah, it was cool. And then just a few moments later, it's this astonishing downpour with lightning and thunder and all that fabulous stuff. And I mean, you never forget that. That was spectacular.
You got a degree in mechanical engineering, and eventually you worked for Boeing designing hydraulic systems. And then you started doing stand-up comedy on the side. How did you get from engineering to entertaining?
Well, I was a senior in college, and the guy who had been my freshman roommate came hurrying to my door. He had cable television, which in the late 70s was quite unusual. And so he brought me up to his house. He was living with a bunch of—we were still good friends, but we just weren't living in the same room anymore. Anyway, he goes, look at this. It's Steve Martin at the boarding house in San Francisco. And it was not on the air television. It was only on cable. And he said, look, this guy's just like you. Look at this. This guy's just like you. So then I got a job at Boeing, and a year later, a whole different set of friends, a whole new set of friends in Seattle, pressured me into entering the Steve Martin lookalike contest because they had observed the same features of my behavior. And I won. And I didn't win the national one. I won the guy who won the national one, man, he really looked like him. He probably still does. And he played the banjo, for crying out loud. But anyway, I started doing stand-up comedy. People wanted me to be Steve Martin at parties. People wanted me to, you know, to do Steve Martin routines on these little television things. And so I started doing stand-up comedy with my own wall-to-wall hilarious engineering jokes. I reached what they call the middle act in comedy. I never headlined, as they say. There's three things. There's the MC, the middle act, and the headline. I middled a few times.
When did you first come up with Bill Nye, the Science Guy?
Oh, I was on the radio, in fact, with a guy named Ross Schaefer, who was a Seattleite who later became the host of the new Match Game. And he had the hottest radio show in Seattle for a while, and he had this radio call-in thing, something or other, and the answer was so many gigawatts. It was to the Back to the Future movie was popular at the time. And I called him and I said, Ross, you know, you can say gigawatts, but it's preferred, you know, we scientists prefer to say, what?
Gigawatts?
A billion watts, yeah, gigawatts. And he said, who are you? And I said, I'm Bill Nye, the Science Guy. You know, just like, whoa, that's it, my destiny. It was just, my goodness. I've done it. And that was in 1986. And I just really, I saw it so clearly. I just said to myself, I want to be the next Mr. Wizard. That's what I want to do. Because I was doing stand-up comedy. I was working as an engineer. And I was also volunteering at the Pacific Science Center here in Seattle. It's like the Franklin
Institute.
Franklin Institute, excuse me, in Philadelphia. You know, it's a place you go to fool with stuff as a kid to learn about science. And I was volunteering there. And I was working at a company that was doing the same things that, in my opinion, people were doing on the space shuttle program. They would put things in inventory that did not work. And they said, well, by the time the customer needs it, you guys will have this thing figured out, this engineering problem figured out. But the problem was not tractable that way. I mean, you couldn't just solve it in a matter of 6 weeks or something. And so I was really frustrated with U.S., at least in those days, aerospace engineering techniques. And I had graduated from college at a time when the Chevy Vega and Ford Pinto had actually been presented to the K car had been presented to the public as things that they would want to buy. And I was really concerned. I was really concerned about the future of this country in science and stuff. And so I wanted to combine all these things. And it took me from the fall of 86 to the spring of 92 to get somebody convinced that it would be worthwhile doing. And it's really been gratifying.
My guest is Bill Nye, the Science Guy. We'll be back after this break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Bill Nye, the Science Guy. He's the host and writer of the show, Bill Nye, the Science Guy, which is nationally syndicated. And you can watch it on PBS on the weekdays, and on the weekends, it airs around the country on commercial stations. Now, in your early incarnation as the Science Guy, I think you did have one bit perfected in which you eat a frozen marshmallow so that steam comes out your nose.
Oh, yeah. I recommend it. So you put a marshmallow in liquid nitrogen, and you chew it, and steam comes out of your nose. It's just a cool way to, you can, if you move your jaw from side to side, and you get a nice, I'm not trying to offend anyone. If you get a puddle of saliva in your on your tongue, you get a really effective steam coming out of your nose. Anybody recommend it? The great thing about liquid nitrogen, Barbara, is it looks so dangerous, yet it is just nitrogen. Which, you know, 3/4 of the air we breathe almost is nitrogen.
Where do you get liquid nitrogen?
Well, your dentist and your physician have liquid nitrogen. And liquid nitrogen is, as we like to say, cheaper than gasoline. It has so many industrial applications that it's made everywhere. People make it all the time. And you know where you get your nitrogen to make your liquid nitrogen, Barbara?
Where?
Out of the air. Right out of the air. So there's a couple companies called Liquid Air. And that's what they make. They refrigerate air so cold, they get it so cold that it turns to a liquid. And most of what you get is nitrogen. You get liquid oxygen, liquid carbon dioxide. Anyway, and then you you put it in a styrofoam cooler, like you would put your soft drinks in. I'm not saying that you would put beer in it, but one might. Then you put the marshmallow in it for a good, over 30 seconds. A minute's good. And then chew it. And steam will come out of your nose. And that's the same thing where you put the rose in it and smash the petals. You put the rubber ball in it, throw it on the floor, and it shatters. You have the pewter bell that just goes bunk, bunk, and then you freeze it, and it goes bing. And you do all that with liquid nitrogen because matter is made of molecules. When you get them cold, the molecules get closer together, and it changes things. They get closer together because they have less internal energy. Huh. It's fabulous. What is it, Barbara? It's science.
Now, you've applied to be an astronaut. Are you in the running? What are your chances?
January 98 is my next rejection postcard.
How often have you been rejected?
Three times. I've applied three times. I've been rejected twice. Excuse me. I've gotten three postcards acknowledging my receipt of my application. I think I'd be, I mean, first of all, athletically, I could do it, and I still have better than 20/20 eyesight. I mean, I feel good about that. And I have a pretty good understanding of aeronautics, astronautics, vacuums, and I've been around very complicated machines like jet aircraft and diving equipment and stuff. I'm very comfortable in those environments, submarines. And I could pull it off, and I think I could do a good job for NASA. I would make people embrace the space program in a way they don't right now.
What do you say to those people who say, look, the space program is too expensive, it's not a priority? What's your rationale for them?
Well, I turn on the news every night, and I'm not talking about the space program, but everybody watches the satellite picture, the Doppler radar of the weather. Everyone accepts now that there's a hole in the ozone. Everyone knows what satellite television is. Everyone knows, everyone wants his or her phone call or radio broadcast to come to him or her via satellite. That's all the space program, let alone the astonishing things we've discovered about the ocean and El Nino and these things about ancient civilizations when the radar was illuminated with radar from space. It's just amazing. I'm not talking about Velcro and all that other stuff that was brought up 20 years ago. Those are cool things, the spin-offs, so-called. But just the fundamental knowledge and expectation you have every day about your environment, we learn so many of those data from space exploration. And every radio television broadcast relies on satellites, for crying out loud. Communication is the key to democracy. So you have to have a space program nowadays to have a democracy.
Bill Nye is host and head writer of Bill Nye the Science Guy, seen weekdays on PBS and weekends on commercial stations.